Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Sorry, got distracted. I've got my lemon and honey tea here again because last night it really, really made the podcasting experience really cozy. It made me feel really good, so I'm doing it again. That might be a thing from now on. I just wish I had discovered this thing 500 episodes ago. The questions that I asked you guys about Book 12, Chapter 6, were, 1. Have you ever made a speech so good that 9 months later you died? And question 2, have you ever gotten more than halfway through a 30-minute speech only to realize that nothing you've said so far has been related to the case at hand, but still been so proud of your mostly pointless speech that you died 9 months later? Referring, of course, to the events that unfolded in yesterday's chapter. That is, you can't argue with that. Those are the things that happened. A guy made a speech that halfway through it was pointed out that nothing he was saying was related to the case at hand. The speech went for 8 pages. 8 crammed in tight pages. It was a long-ass speech. About half of it was off-point, literally pointless. And 9 months later, he died of speech pride. He was so proud of his speech that he just gave up on life. If anyone still claims that this is a good book at this point, no, I'm messing with you. It's a great book, but I don't know what to tell you. I think yesterday's chapter was maybe the worst chapter in the book, and I think you guys have got to agree with me on that. Like, that was rubbish. He died. The funny thing is, like, all through this book I've been just irked by how Dostoevsky makes everything so extreme. Like, it's never like he said, it's like he screeched, he cried, or they don't like get up. It's like he leapt from his chair. Everything is just like to the extreme. These people are bouncing across the room and then speaking for 15 minutes without taking a breath. And the other person at this point must just be standing there giving them eye contact for 15 minutes while they talk. And then suddenly both of them are like bouncing off the walls and screeching and crying and squealing and almost fainting. Oh yeah, he almost fainted from making his speech as well. And it's just as if in this chapter he was like, oh man, how can I, like, make this even more extreme? Like, so people really feel the emotions behind it. You know, they're always screaming and crying and jumping and leaping and... whoa, man, what's the next level? Oh, I know. He died. It was so amazing he died. And then it wasn't even good. Somastar says, today's questions made me laugh. 9 months later, I died from it. Thanks, Somastar. Yeah, don't laugh too much. You might die. And I'm proud of those questions for making you laugh, but I better not be too proud of them, or I might die in 9 months of sentence pride for making sentences I'm so happy about. Swim said, the Mama Fishy said, anyone who has sat through death by PowerPoint presentations and speeches or given them wishes for death at least 9 minutes in. Oh, yeah, I gave one to some poor Year 7 kids the other day. And they did an hour-long workshop broken into halves with activities in it, and I had to tell them about these writing things, which are interesting. But the presentations are meant to go for about 15 minutes each, with about a 15-minute activity each, which would add up to about an hour between two of them. So it's only half an hour of talking, split among an hour, 15 minutes at a time. That's all right. And it's interesting stuff that I'm talking about. But these kids, these Year 7 kids, they didn't care. They weren't interested. And when you get a room full of disinterested kids, even the ones who are interested, there's no buzz in the room. Like, no one's feeling it. Like, it's a dead energy. Yeah. I'd talk and talk and talk, just getting no feedback. And also then, when you're talking to a crowd and they're giving you nothing, you tend to start overemphasizing your points and kind of like ranting a bit too much. And I'd talk and I'd say, all right, does that make sense to everyone? And nothing. Like, they wouldn't even respond to yes or no, whether or not they were following. So they wouldn't even respond to say, no, that doesn't make sense, or yes, that makes sense. Does that make sense, guys? 100 kids blankly staring at me. I felt so bad for them. And it's just so funny how the audience's attitude and energy will change how entertaining the presentation is. Because the stuff I'm presenting is actually pretty interesting stuff, I think. And I think a lot of other people have found it interesting. And I've given the same presentations at different schools before and had just the opposite effect. But yeah, the energy, it's funny. And then I became, so with a dead energy in the whole room and you're up there trying to elicit some interest, like, I don't know. It's just too quiet. It's too dead. It's too dull. And you become the energy vampire, so to speak, up the front, droning on and on about something. I felt really bad for him. Ah, poor people. Poor kids. JMama8779 said, wow, after so many good chapters, the entire momentum of this section of the book comes to a screeching halt. This chapter was downright painful. Did anyone else feel this way? Yes. Yes, I did. Good. I like that, reading that, because I just said I think this is the worst chapter in the book. So it's good to see straight off the bat that it seems, or at least one other person would agree with that. Swim said the Mama Fishy also with a death by PowerPoint comment might also agree. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, I didn't find it painful per se, though it is obvious that Dostoevsky is using the prosecutor to lecture us / rant on his theme of interest. I'm guessing he is trying to wrap things up. I was surprised that he equated Ivan to his dad, though there seems to be some jealousy there. I am Norwegian said, I enjoyed the chapter, but I also thought that this might be Dosto ranting at us. But I don't think that is the case exactly. Ippolit has removed the humanity from the court case. He is not talking about Dmitri murdering his father, but how the murder reflects on the trajectory of Russia, the direction of the Troika. The real horror of the case is not the murder itself, but the fact that such dark affairs have almost ceased to horrify us. He is making the case that Russia has lost its way, and Dmitri is window dressing in that argument. Ippolit has earlier been described as overconfident, especially in his own assumption of having special insights about the psychology of man. He feels underappreciated in his profession. Wait, he has a profession? Oh, Ippolit, sorry, I was thinking of Ivan. And was eager to take on the case because he thought it would become famous all over Russia, which it did. And at that same time, Ippolit was described as having a kind soul. I think the word humane was used. But he is still convicting an innocent man of murder he did not commit. Now, notice how he compared Alyosha's faith as him running away from ghosts to his mother Russia. Not something Dosto would have agreed with. And yet he reflects the themes of the book quite well in a way that I think Dosto would have agreed with. It might just be the case that Dosto is being nuanced here, speaking through an imperfect man who, despite his faults, is onto something. Haha, I have talked myself into uncertainty. Good comment. I am Norwegian, thank you. A lot of insight into what was happening in the chapter in that comment. especially in regards to, what was it, the bit that struck me? Oh my God, I just blanked on it. There was one bit that stood out. Alyosha's faith as him. Oh my God, I'm going to have to read the whole comment again to figure out which bit. Good comment. All right, good comment. I'm just going to move on. Laura Weistich said, I'm not sure about Dostoevsky. Sorry, I had a sip of my tea mid-thought and forgot my thought. So let's just move on. Laura Weistich said, I'm not sure about Dostoevsky lecturing us. I found the prosecutor slightly ridiculous. He talks about things that have nothing to do with the case and starts getting carried away with his eloquence. Yeah, I don't know what it was either. It's like a lecturer, but then he's kind of self... It's like he's ranting, but he's also being like self-deprecating because he's kind of aware that he's doing... He's just ranting. And then he's kind of doing his own devil's advocate enmeshed in it. He's teetering on various points, I think, and not really making any of them. Dirt Burglar said, I thought it was amusing that the prosecutor spent half this chapter talking about the victim's moral failings and indecency. Kind of a funny and unexpected thing for a prosecutor to do, and you have to wonder if it's calculated or just an undisciplined rant. Undisciplined writing, I think, is what it is. I Am Norwegian said, people don't seem to feel guilt anymore, do they? Hey, that was quoting me, I think, from yesterday or the day before. Hey, seems Dosto was right about another thing. Yeah, it's the whole... Well, that was Dosto's big thing, right? Which Nietzsche took and ran with. I'm not sure I agree that it's a problem to write with a point in mind. Oh, this is going back to my point yesterday. Cool, yeah, cool. I just lost my place. I'm not sure that it's a problem to write with a point in mind. Notes from Underground was written with two goals, to critique utopian rationalism and to illustrate what would become known as existentialism. It was a warning of that new kind of suffering. I've been watching Star Trek TNG recently, and I've been blown away by how well it's written, in spite of every episode having some kind of moral point. More often than not, the climax of the episode is just Captain Picard listing off morally correct ways to handle a situation, and it's always awesome. I will say that 90% of the time you are correct, though. If someone tells me that a movie was made to prove a point, I'm going to expect some patronizing message shoved down my throat. The Brothers Karamazov has been compared to a work of philosophy in literary clothes, and a work of philosophy with this as its conclusion wouldn't be very satisfying. And the word this is a link to a picture of a guy shrugging. All right, yeah, so its conclusion does seem to be, I don't know. But that's, I mean, any philosophy, really. That's like, and that's what's true, but then what is truth? Oh my God. I haven't watched Star Trek TNG. I've only watched that new Netflix one, really. Like, I mean, fully watched a full series. And the odd older episodes of Star Trek here and there, but I've never sat down and gone through a series. Star Trek, what's Enterprise? No, what's the current one on Netflix? Weird that I would ask that on a one-way medium. Star Trek, I'll just Google it. Enterprise? Is it Enterprise? Is that the latest one with Michael Burnham? No. Star Trek, oh God, this is such bad. Discovery. Is it Discovery? Yes. Okay, that's what I've been watching. Star Trek Discovery. That's not bad. It's a bit too much like bombs and guns and action fights and you know what I mean? Like they've put a little bit too much Star Wars into Star Trek, and I've also watched every episode of The Orville, which I think is awesome. I think The Orville is probably closer to what you're saying, where they do seem to have a bit of a social point to make or some point that they're kind of angling at. But yeah, no, you're right. It's not always the case that writing trying to prove a certain point is bad. But I just think, yeah, often it is. Often it is. Sometimes it's not. Yeah. But if I had to choose one or the other, I think I prefer them where they're exploring, where they're not out to point anything out. They're there just to see what happens. Oh my God, I'm sorry. It's 2 a.m. If I'm rambling a bit, it's because it's 2 a.m. I Am Norwegian said, it's amazing, referring to TNG. It's so nice to have a show where just about every episode has its own individual plot too. That's rare nowadays outside of network garbage. Techrific said, great series. All right, look, I'm going to go and watch Star Trek TNG. I'm pretty sure it's on Netflix. Screw it. I'll do it. Uncle Drosselmeyer said, please correct me if I'm wrong. It seems that Nikolai Gogol was the first person who compared Russia to a troika. Excuse me. Oh, that's a big yawn. As we can see in this chapter, a troika is a Russian vehicle impulsed by three horses. The word troika is related to the number three. Also, troika means the government when the administration is under the rule of three official powers, a triumvirate, in common words, apparently. Not related to perestroika. The suffix stroika means building, nothing to do with troika, three. Perestroika means rebuilding. Thanks. Well, Uncle Drosselmeyer, you've prefixed that by saying, correct me if I'm wrong. And you know what? I'm going to take your word for it, because I don't know what any of that means. No, I do. Your Russian is clearly better than mine. All right. Let's move on and read the next chapter, which is chapter 7. And it is... Oh, it's short. It's 4 pages long, and I'm so glad, because it's 2 a.m. and I want to go to bed. That's my own fault. But I am glad to see a short chapter tonight, especially because I left it so late. A sip of honey lemon tea, and we're good to go. It's called, chapter 7, An Historical Survey. The medical experts have striven to convince us that the prisoner is out of his mind, and in fact, a maniac. I maintain that he is in his right mind, and that if he had not been, he would have behaved more cleverly. As for his being a maniac, that I would agree with, but only in one point, that is his fixed idea about the 3,000. Yet, I think one might find a much simpler cause than his tendency to fear insanity. For my part, I agree thoroughly with the young doctor who maintained that the prisoner's mental faculties have always been normal and that he has only been irritable and exasperated. The object of the prisoner's continual and violent anger was not the sum itself. There was a special motive at the bottom of it. That motive is jealousy. Here, Ippolit Kirillovich described at length the... this is still Ippolit talking. Holy shit. Okay. Whoa. Here Ippolit described at length the prisoner's fatal passion for Grushenka. It began from the moment when the prisoner went to the young person's lodgings to beat her. I use his own expression, the prosecutor explained. But instead of beating her, he remained there at her feet. That was the beginning of the passion. At the same time, the prisoner's father was captivated by the same young person, a strange and fatal coincidence, for they both lost their hearts to her simultaneously, though both had known her before. And she inspired in both of them the most violent, characteristically Karamazov passion. We have her own confession. Oh my God. Excuse me, I was laughing at both of them. Yes, the sudden desires to make a jest of them came over her, and she conquered both of them at once. Oh, that was my neck cracking. That was probably really gross for you guys. I apologize for that. Conquered both of them at once. The old man who worshipped money at once set aside 3,000 rubles as a reward for one visit from her, but soon after that, he would have been happy to lay his property and his name at her feet if only she would become his lawful wife. You know, it's funny. I used to be really careful not to make any noises other than talking into the microphone during a podcast. Like, I wouldn't take a sip of a drink. If I yawned, I would, like, you know, cut it out. All that kind of stuff. And now I'm, like, drinking, taking gulps of tea, cracking my neck, yawning. Oh, God. I suppose when you do it every single night, you just have to, like, take a few little liberties, right? I can't be snipping all these yawns and sips and stuff out of my podcast. I don't have time for that. We have good evidence of this. As for the prisoner, the tragedy of his fate is evident. It is before us. But such was the young person's game. The enchantress gave the unhappy young man no hope until the last moment when he knelt before her, stretching out hands that were already stained with blood of his father and rival. It was in that position that he was arrested. Send me to Siberia with him. I have brought him to this. I am most to blame. The woman herself cried, in genuine remorse at the moment of his arrest. The talented young man, to whom I have referred already, Mr. Rakitin, characterized this heroine in brief and impressive terms. She was disillusioned early in life, deceived and ruined by a betrothed who seduced and abandoned her. She was left in poverty, cursed by her respectable family, and taken under the protection of a wealthy old man whom she still, however, considers as her benefactor. There was perhaps much that was good in her young heart, but it was embittered too early. She became prudent and saved money. She grew sarcastic and resentful against society. After this sketch of her character, it may well be understood that she might laugh at both of them simply from mischief, from malice. After a month of hopeless love and moral degradation, during which he betrayed his betrothed and appropriately money entrusted to his honour, the prisoner was driven almost to frenzy, almost to madness by continual jealousy, and of whom his father. And the worst of it was that crazy old man was alluring and enticing the object of his affection by means of that very 3,000 rubles, which the son looked upon as his own property, but part of his inheritance from his mother, of which his father was cheating him. Yes, I admit, it was hard to bear. It might well drive a man to madness. It was not the money, but the fact that this money was used with such revolting cynicism to ruin his happiness. Then the prosecutor went on to describe how the idea of murdering his father had entered the prisoner's head and illustrated his theory with facts. At first he only talked about it in taverns. He was talking about it all that month. Ah, he likes being always surrounded with company, and he likes to tell his companions everything. Even his most diabolical and dangerous ideas he likes to share every thought with others, and expects, for some reason, that those he confides in will meet him with perfect sympathy, enter into all his troubles and anxieties, take his part and not oppose him in anything. If not, he flies into a rage and smashes up everything in the tavern. Then followed the anecdote about Captain Snigaryov. Those who heard the prisoner began to think at last that he might mean more than threats, and that such a frenzy might turn threats into actions. Here the prosecutor described the meeting of the family at the monastery, the conversations with Alyosha, and the horrible scene of violence when the prisoner had rushed into his father's house after dinner. I cannot positively assert, the prosecutor continued, that the prisoner fully intended to murder his father before that incident, yet the idea had several times presented itself, and he had deliberated on it. For that we have facts, witnesses, and his own words. I confess, gentlemen of the jury, he added, that till today I have been uncertain whether to attribute to the prisoner conscious premeditation. I was firmly convinced that he had pictured the fatal moment beforehand, but had only pictured it, contemplating it as a possibility. He had not definitely considered when and how he might commit the crime, but I was only uncertain until today. Till that fateful document was presented to the court just now. Now, you yourselves heard that young lady's exclamation. It is the plan, the program of the murder. That is how she defined that miserable drunken letter of the unhappy prisoner, and in fact, from that letter we see that the whole fact of the murder was premeditated. It was written 2 days before, and so we know now for a fact that 48 hours before the perpetration of his terrible design, The prisoner swore that if he could not get money next day, he would murder his father in order to take the envelope with the notes from under his pillow as soon as Ivan had left. As soon as Ivan had gone away. You hear that? So he had thought everything out, weighing every circumstance, and he carried it all out just as he had written it. The proof of premeditation is conclusive. The crime must have been committed for the sake of the money. That is stated clearly. That is written and signed. The prisoner does not deny his signature. I shall be told he was drunk when he wrote it. But that does not diminish the value of the letter. Quite the contrary, he wrote when drunk what he had planned when sober. He had not planned it when sober. He would not have written it when drunk. I shall be asked, then why did he talk about it in taverns? A man who premeditates such a crime is silent and keeps it to himself. Yes, but he talked about it before he had formed a plan, when he had only the desire, only the impulse to do it. Afterwards, he talked less about it. On the evening he wrote that letter to the Metropolis Tavern, contrary to his custom, he was silent, though he had been drinking. He did not play billiards. He sat in a corner, talked to no one. He did indeed turn a shopman out of his seat, but that was done almost unconsciously because he could never enter a tavern without making a disturbance. It is true that after he had taken the final decision, he must have felt apprehensive that he had talked too much about his design beforehand, and that this might lead to his arrest and prosecution afterwards, but there was nothing for it. He could not take his words back, but his luck had served him before. It would serve him again. He believed in his star, you know. I must confess, too, that he did a great deal to avoid the fatal catastrophe. Tomorrow I shall try and borrow the money from everyone, as he writes in his peculiar language, and if they won't give it to me, there will be bloodshed. Here Ippolit Kirillovich passed to a detailed description of all Mitch's efforts to borrow the money. He described his visit to Samsonov, his journey to Lagavi, harassed, jeered at hunger, and selling his watch to pay for his journey, though he tells us he had 1,500 rubles on him, a likely story, tortured by jealousy at having left the object of his affection in the town, suspecting that she would go to Fyodor Pavlovich in his absence. He returned at last to the town to find, to his joy, that she had not been near his father. He accompanied her himself to the protector. Strange to say, he doesn't seem to have been jealous of Samsonov, which is psychologically interesting. Then he hastens back to his ambush in the back gardens and learns that Smerdyakov is in a fit, that the other servants is ill, the coast is clear, and he knows the signals. What a temptation. He resists it. He goes off to a lady who has for some time been residing in the town and who is highly esteemed among us, Madame Holokov. That lady, who had long watched his career with compassion, gave him the most judicious advice to give up his dissipated life, his unseemly love affair, and the waste of his youth and vigour in pothouse debauchery, and to set off to Siberia to the gold mines. That would be an outlet for your turbulent energies, your romantic character, your thirst for adventure. After describing the result of this conversation and the moment when the prisoner learnt that Grushenka had not remained at Samsonov's, the sudden frenzy of the luckless man, worn out with jealousy and nervous exhaustion at the thought that she had deceived him and was now with his father, Ippolit Kirillovich concluded by dwelling upon the fatal influence of chance. Had the maid told him that her mistress was at Mokroe with her former lover, nothing would have happened. But she lost her head. She could only swear and protest her ignorance. And if the prisoner did not kill her on the spot, it was only because he flew in pursuit of his false mistress. But note, frantic as he was, he took with him a brass pestle. Why that? Why not some other weapon? But since he had been contemplating his plan and preparing himself for it for the whole month, he would snatch up anything like a weapon that caught his eye. He had realized for a month past that any object of the kind would serve as a weapon, so he instantly, without hesitation, recognized that it would serve his purpose. So it was by no means unconsciously, by no means involuntary, that he snatched up that fatal pestle, and then we find him in his father's garden. The coast is clear, there are no witnesses, darkness and jealousy. The suspicion that she was there with him, with his rival in his arms, and perhaps laughing at him at that moment. took his breath away, and it was not mere suspicion. The deception was open, obvious. She must be there, in that lighted room. She must be behind the screen, and the unhappy man would have us believe that he stole up the window, peeped respectfully in, and discreetly withdrew, for fear something terrible and immoral should happen. And he tries to persuade us of that, us who understand his character, who know his state of mind at the moment, and that he knew the signals by which he could at once enter the house. At this point, Hippolyte Kirillovich broke off to discuss exhaustively the suspected connection of Smerdyakov with the murder. He did this very circumstantially, and everyone realized that although he professed to despise that suspicion, he thought the subject of great importance. Alright, that's the end of the chapter. Am I missing something there? He just said that he believed that the lady was in the house. He believed that Grushenka was in the house, and that's why he wanted to get in there and murder his dad. And so he used the secret knock that would tell his dad that Grushenka had arrived to get in. But Grushenka was already in there in his head. So why would you use that secret knock? And why would his dad be like, oh, the secret knock, Grushenka must be here, if Grushenka was already in there? Anyway, he didn't seem to notice that. That doesn't make any sense. Probably Dosto didn't notice that. That doesn't make any sense. Doesn't matter. That's the end of that chapter. Have your say on it over at the Reddit. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.